Right, Steph, yeah.
Well, one more time, let's try to claim that John Glenn in 1962 was the first American to orbit the Earth after Gagarin had done it the year before. What this is all leading to, what's the bigger concept going on here in number four? There is a space race going on. The space race doesn't start in 61 with these people. It's really started when? Sputnik in 57. So from 57 into the early 60s, there is this Russian-American competition to see who can be the first to get into space. And it's not just for scientific exploration. What's the ramifications?
ICBMs.
Yeah, for defense. To be defended from attack from space. And that's where Kennedy, as the newly elected president, makes the pledge that we will be the first nation to place a man on the moon before the decade is over, which does occur during the Nixon administration in number 5 on July 20th, 69, when Neil Armstrong goes for a walk on the moon. But maybe you can comment on this more than me. It is said that those fires that occur in 1967 in Cape Canaveral probably didn't have to happen because we were in such a rush to
the pure oxygen atmosphere.
Yeah, that we were in such a rush to get there in time that there were reckless steps taken. Back to the civil rights issue.
The space program is always, I mean, the Challenger, if we hadn't been launching
launching in cold weather with the bad O-rings.
By the way, this is something you've probably never heard. Turn that. Trust me. Okay, that can stay up. But I was at this thing at the University of Missouri, Rolla, and there's ever a space flight, they have to be okayed by all the different manufacturers of different parts and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who make the O-rings.
Morton Thiokol?
I don't know who did
it.
But there's a board, and like there's a board of people concerned about money, and then they're like two engineers. And then the engineer said, and he didn't give his okay, and he said, why? Because of the temperature, and that had been tested and stuff.
And they ignored his warning?
No, I think that's what they sent. Then NASA called them back and told them, are you sure? Because if we don't launch, the American people will lose faith in our program because we've delayed it so much.
So did he cave?
So then the board takes another vote, and it's they say, we're going to... But they don't let him vote or something or other. So they have a vote, and he's not a vote, doesn't get a vote or something.
So they approve it.
So they approve it, and then that guy went to an insane asylum after he saw it happen. But now he, like after 6 years of recovery, he's going and talking.
Wow, what a story.
Institutional. Well, not an insane asylum. He was institutionalized. Yeah. Because he was like...
That's the story. That's the flight that had Christy McAuliffe aboard, wasn't it?
The teacher.
Yeah.
But he was like, his problem was, who could he have gone to?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. The courage it takes to be a whistleblower in regards to...
But, I mean, it happened the next day.
Civil rights movement resumes. We're on item 6. So 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12... All of those will be civil rights related. And there should be another one down here. 13, yes, it's definitely for us. Oh, on the next page, it resumes with numbers 22, 23, and 24 together, and 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30. So... We'll do this in split halves because of the years going on, but they have had twice civil rights essays in the past, so it's a potential. We have what happened in the 50s with the Montgomery bus boycott, and then we have the Little Rock affair. There is, in 1957, a civil rights bill passed, shepherded through Senate by the Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson, future president. But it's not really one of strong binding import, and so while it is a civil rights bill, it's not the one that gets the recognition of 1964. We're on number 6. The first event of the 1960s is the Woolworths sit-in in Greensboro, North Carolina, which African Americans came in to eat lunch and refused to leave until they were served, and of course they were not served. Instead, they were dragged out by the police and arrested. And their argument was that the Jim Crow laws violated the 14th Amendment rights. what happened is it wasn't a planned national event. It was just it sparked, I would use the phrase copycat, but that sounds so negative. It inspired, fell a role model future events in which all across the South, other African Americans came to these Woolworths lunch counters and sat in and refused to move. A year later, in 1961, black and white students organized a plan to board buses in Washington, D.C., and travel to New Orleans in integrated fashion on the buses so that once they get into these southern cities, they'll be clearly in violation of Jim Crow laws. And they're wanting publicity to follow, to say that they refuse to follow these Jim Crow measures. And as they get from city to city and more publicity follows them, so do the bigots, since we're not saying rednecks are rednecks anymore. Okay, and so the bigots follow and eventually start to drag them off the buses in certain cities and attack while the police nearby stand and watch. When word of this gets back to the White House, Attorney General Robert Kennedy dispatches federal marshals to protect and finally bring them into custody before they get killed, because they never would have made it to New Orleans anyway. So what's happening here if you put the Woolworths sit-in and the Freedom Rides together? What's happening?
Hey, wasn't there didn't somebody die on the Freedom Ride?
No, they just got the crap beat out of them.
I don't think anybody died.
There was a white guy that got pulled off the bus and got really, really beat up, but he didn't die.
You know, there has been, in more recent decades, friction between the Jewish community and the black community, but a number of these early civil rights advocates, including the sit-ins and the voter registration booths, were Jewish students from the North who helped.
When was there friction?
In more recent decades.
Without Jewish-black relations, hip-hop as we know it today would not be...
Good point. James Meredith, a Air Force veteran.
Did you say that Alabama, University of Alabama?
That will come up in number 8. That's separate from the Freedom Rides.
Never mind. Okay.
James Meredith, a Air Force veteran, decorated, wants to go to college on GI Bill money. And rather than going to traditional black colleges, he decides to go to Ole Miss that has what do you call it? What's a team mascot? A team mascot.
Yeah,
the Rebels, like the South Side. So this is the first black person to try to integrate the University of Mississippi, and the governor of Mississippi takes a step in preventing him.
Was he racist, or was it what the people wanted?
Jordan Walsh was for Alabama.
Alabama, yeah. Mississippi was Ross Barnett, I think his name. I don't know Ross Barnett personally that well, but my impression is that, like most Southern governors, it's a political suicide to support civil rights, regardless of your personal feelings. But as it turns out, the federal government took a hand in demanding that he be admitted in regards to the Brown case. And he did finally graduate. Later in 66, he was involved in a civil rights march in which he was shot and injured and survived that, though.
So did he go to school then?
He finished. He graduated, yes.
And because the federal government made...
Forced them to protect his right to go.
And the University of Mississippi is a public college?
Yes. And the year later, the same occurred in the University of Alabama, and that's where George Wallace tried to prevent it. And again, the federal government took a step into protecting the rights of those.
And George Wallace was a little bit outspoken.
Segregation today, segregation now, tomorrow, and forever. Okay.
Who was the governor?
George Wallace. Did you see Forrest Gump?
Yeah.
This scene about the girl going into the University of Alabama where she drops the book, and Forrest Gump runs up and picks up, "You dropped your book, man." That was this incident. In the summer of 64, in item 9, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee brings black and white volunteers to the South, to Mississippi and Alabama, especially Mississippi, in an effort to register voters to vote.
What does that stand for?
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. There's another organization I forgot to mention before. The one that King led was called the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC.
They're both committees?
There are civil rights organizations. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference is a basic civil rights thing to stop Jim Crow law, desegregate things. SNCC is based on registering non-voters, or registering voters. When was the last time that blacks had voted in Mississippi? Maybe 1868?
Yeah.
Were there northern troops there to protect them?
Well, then the populace
well,
well
that's,
for a while.
That's probably true. But there may have been some lingering voting as far as the 1870s and 80s.
Well, remember the populace were rallying with black women when they thought they couldn't
that's
own
good
black
point.
Them,
that's a good point. I was in the impression that Mississippi was so hardcore they disfranchised them right after Reconstruction. But they may well have been continuing until the 1890s when the populist situation touched that off. But it surely wasn't since the 20th century had started.
Or at least the black people could pay the poll tax and pass the literacy test and all that.
Until that was just always stomped out completely by the mid-1980s.
So
good point.
So
could have been as early as the 1870s, may have been as late as the 1890s, but the point is it had been 70 years or more since any black people had voted in Mississippi. So when you have outsiders, young erudite, Yankee black people and Jewish people, moving into southern places where they don't belong, so to speak, registering local black people to vote, what's that the breeding ground for?
Wait, what state was the SN60?
Where they did Mississippi predominantly, but also in Alabama and Georgia. Just trying to register people to vote is a real affront to the traditional Jim Crow feeling of that period.
And these were white people?
White and black students.
Oh, white and black.
They had to pay their own way. They had to give up going to school for the, or working that summer in order to be a part of this movement. So what a sacrifice it was. Pay your own way and take a risk of getting killed. And this is something that I'm not ever familiar with mentally, but I think it's the year before that in 63, there is the death of Medgar Evers, NAACP leader in the South. And then there is the death of those three civil rights workers from the North in what's called Mississippi Burning. But I'm not well-versed enough to remember how that fits in the story. Year after year, I get lost on this every time I try to go through it. I understand it when I read it, but it's hard to lecture. And number 10, in April of 1963, King...
So what happened to these students?
Oh, they got a lot of people registered to vote, and in a lot of cases the registrations are thrown out and refused to be recognized by the state organizations.
Or by the county clerks.
And so therefore, what is it really leading to? Forcing the federal government to override state actions and guaranteeing vote registration, which will come in the form of number 24 on the next page, the Voting Rights Act, which we'll look at. King leads an effort to desegregate facilities in Birmingham, Alabama. He wants to hold a march to protest. The city council informs him that he cannot receive the permit because they're a new council and they've got enough problems as is. They don't want to face the controversies that a civil rights march will cause. Without the marching permit, he still holds the march anyway. The police come out, led by Eugene Bull Connors, using attack dogs, water hoses that can rip the bark off trees. And as these people are being hit with electric cattle prods and chewed up by German shepherds and blasted down the street by water hoses, how are they reacting?
They keep marching.
They refuse to fight back. It's the Gandhi passive resistance response.
Is this the same Birmingham as the letter from Birmingham?
Yes, this is it. When he is arrested and taken to jail, King receives a number of letters from fellow religious ministers who say that he had pushed things too quickly, that he had challenged the social sensitivities of that area, and that he's hurting the movement, he should wait. And the letter from Birmingham Jail is a response saying that we've been waiting since the 1860s, we were told to wait back in the 1890s. It's the same thing over and over, we can wait no longer, that only by pushing the issue can civil rights come to be.
It's 7
and 10.
Oh, 9 and 10.
So that's why you can see from the events from 60, 61, 62, and 63 with the sit-ins, the freedom rides, these desegregation of colleges, the voter registration move, the which was taking place even before 64, and the Alabama-Birmingham event. This is forcing the Kennedy administration to not just sit on the sideline, but take a position either for or against advancing civil rights. And JFK finally, in the summer of 63, proposes a civil rights legislation package. And in an effort to try to boost public opinion for that, a peace rally is held in August of 63 in D.C., the Poor People's March. Look who's involved in the organizing. Labor leader Bayard Rustin and our ever-famous Asa Philip Randolph.
That could be it's turned like it's an AP test. Mm-hmm. AP Randolph.
Mm-hmm. He was born in 1889, didn't die until 1979. King was not as well known as people believe at the time he gave the speech. I mean, he was one of the many elements involved in the civil rights movement, but it seems that the giving of that speech and the TV coverage, and he wasn't definitely the only speaker that day, helps catapult him to the central leadership position in the image of most Americans. And, of course, that occurs in August of 63, and by November of 63, Kennedy's assassinated, and I mentioned the fact that Johnson used the assassination of Kennedy as a way to help move along the legislation.
Is it true that he gave the dream speech many times?
You mean in practice before he ended?
No, like at other rallies?
Yeah, I think he used elements of many of his speeches over and over. This one gets the most famous publicity, though. One of the things the organizers were deeply concerned about is they wanted to make sure none of the speeches were too militant, like Black Panther type language. And they wanted to make, because they didn't want this to be an in-your-face, challenge white, you know, comfort area. They wanted this to be something where people would be sympathetic. And so they were very cautious about who spoke and how many white people were up on the platform with black people to make it look integrated in the television cameras.
No Kill Witty?
Yeah, definitely no Kill Witty activity.
Kill Witty.
Dying is here.
Yep.
Osama, there's an inside joke there, so don't take that wrong.
I think you're going to get arrested by Homeland Security for sending messages to Osama.
What's this Warren Commission?
Well, let's talk about Kennedy's assassination. Not in great detail, because I don't know how much it'd be on the AP test, but who is considered to be the killer?
Oswald.
Lee Harvey Oswald. What do we know about Oswald's past?
He was a Marine sniper.
Marine. Later a sniper, I guess. He was a Marine. He spent time where?
Texas.
Russia.
Russia.
He got disgusted with America.
That's Russia. Right.
Went to Russia. Yeah, they kicked him out. He went to Cuba. Castro kicked him out. So everybody always wonders, was there some kind of connection between, was he like set up by the Russians and Cubans to kill Kennedy? And the records came out of the KGB when Russia stopped being communist. They said, no, this guy was a nutcase too, and we kicked him out.
How does he get this money to just travel around the world?
I wonder a lot.
I think like only they had like some secrecy of the KGB. They left it at that.
I think
it's in the back.
A very bad film to not watch is the Oliver Stone JFK film.
Does that mean we should or should not?
Should not. Okay. It's
supposed to be fiction.
It sure made it.
Yeah.
If you're looking for some kind of historical stuff, it's full of conspiracy theories that I have. Now, another film, which is probably as convoluted as the JFK one, but I do suggest worth watching, is the Nixon. The Nixon film, the Oliver Stone Nixon film.
Oliver Stone made that with Anthony
Hopkins. Yeah. And I wouldn't say that there's, like the Kennedy film, there's lots of innuendo about referring to the Bay of Pigs in a way as though they're covering up something. I mean, there's a lot of falsities in there, but what is very valuable in that film is Anthony Hopkins, when you first start to see him, doesn't look like Nixon, and you're thinking this isn't going to fly. But by the end of the film, you've come to see Nixon as Hopkins. I mean, you come to the way his shoulder and his movements and the voice tone, you get not history, but psychology of Nixon comes right through. It is Nixon. You can feel it. It's a very freaky feeling.
Mr. Stone, do you have the textbook?
Who directed the good show? Robert De Niro.
Oh, well, he didn't want the textbook to be brought out today.
Did he have to show the JFK article?
For all the Mafia and CIA.
This one says JFK assassinated by Mafia, CIA, Klan, Duke.
Which is related to what we're talking about here is who was the really at fault? Who did the assassination?
Enough to show
who is Jack Ruby in this story?
He's the guy who killed the guy who killed Kennedy.
Mm-hmm. He came and killed him in the police station, and there was always curiosity as to whether Ruby was part of some other bigger plot to hush Oswald up. It appears that Ruby just was a very patriotic person, pro-Kennedy, and was angered by Oswald doing it, and there's no connection. The investigation of the assassination came through what's called the Warren Commission, headed by Chief Justice Earl Warren. And what are the conclusions? Still very suspicious by most people today.
That Oswald acted alone.
That he acted alone, and that there was actually one single bullet that killed Kennedy that went through Kennedy and into Connally, the governor of Texas.
But he didn't know, did he?
No, he
said that it was a normal bullet.
As opposed to that. The thing is magical.
That would really be.
And it was his own.
There was a future U.S. president serving on the Warren Commission. Who would that be?
Reagan?
Ford. Gerald Ford.
Who's naming presidents from that?
Reagan was never in anything but the governor, right?
Yeah, I went from Screen Actors Guild president to California governor.
Was that governor of California before president?
Well, he made it to president later, too.
The Screen Actors.
I like to try to ignore that part of history.
Oh. But well, you said Screen Actors Guild is president to Governor Powell.
But it's hard.
Land in Dallas, didn't he?
What did you say? He, after
I'm afraid these are not going to be the best of the online notes.
After he served as president, he served as governor?
No. The Screen Actors Guild president, he became governor.
Okay.
He's the only, to my knowledge, the only president who's been a labor leader.
Oh, that's so ironic.
Yeah. Israel, yeah, it is.
Reaganomics, dude, the head of the labor
movement. Yeah. And the only president to be divorced, isn't he?
Is that divorced?
Jane Wyman, his first wife, he divorced for Betty Davis. Not Betty Davis, what's her name? Nancy Davis.
Reagan?
Yeah. Nancy Davis.
I was confused.
It's a different
I had no
Davis.
Idea. That
just
they
know, Mr. Jones.
I saw one of his musicals.
Uh-huh. Let me say something about Reagan in movies. I think it's possible that you could actually. See, every time I see Reagan in a movie, I'm always thinking, boy, he's a bad actor. But I don't think he really is a bad actor. I think that once you're so anti-Reagan, you can't have a clear, neutral mind.
No, it was
in the
a
movie.
Bad movie, though. I didn't say anything about his performance.
Okay.
I blocked it.
Well, here's some things about the Kennedy assassination of significance, and that was. Unlike previous presidents, and I'm thinking McKinley especially, and Garfield, both who languished for quite some time, Garfield for nearly 6 months, didn't he, before he finally died? In fact, he didn't need to die. I think it was Garfield that the doctors poked around and dug in him to look for the bullet, and that's what killed him. If they hadn't, he would have probably lived.
Oh, yeah. They might get a magnet
mm-hmm.
thing over him to find the bullet, except he went on a mattress full of metal springs.
Oh, my gosh. But, So the point is, though, that there was no hurry to replace McKinley and Garfield with the next person up. And in the case of Kennedy, within 90 minutes of his death, on the plane flying back to Washington, not even waiting for a ceremony back in Washington, LBJ was inaugurated. What was the hurry?
Well, because it's the Soviets.
That's it. It's in a time period when a commander-in-chief needed to be ready to respond to a potential Soviet threat with the nuke button, that was expected the appropriate thing to do in a hurry. And that also led in many ways to the 25th. Thank you. I always get that in mind. What the 25th Amendment?
The nuclear amendment.
What did the 25th Amendment do?
It generated the order of secession.
And one of the most important things is it filled in the gap of vice presidency. Prior to this time period, all the way up till the 64 election, if a vice president became a president, the vice presidency just remained vacant. But as of the 25th Amendment, and it's not just Kennedy's assassination. There was also a heart attack for Eisenhower in 55 that made people wonder if he had languished, what would we have done in the 50s? So this amendment addresses immediate succession. And it does more than just who moves up in terms of, like, which cabinet member comes next. It also deals with the issue of what if a president suffers a stroke or an injury or incapacitated and can't think clearly but isn't dead. That was never addressed or thought of before. And so what does the 25th Amendment do for that?
It gives a procedure to go through, like the cabinet can declare the president mentally incompetent if he says these puns.
Why don't we have a doctor declare?
Is it possible that a intrigue scheme could be used to get a sane president out of office against his will?
There was a movie about that.
Good one.
What was it?
That you do the voting thing, then you have 90 days to have a coup.
What's the movie?
I forget the title. I don't know the title, the director, the five main actors.
The original one in the 60s? Or the
original the Manchurian Candidate?
The original? You know, that was made before the Kennedy administration and then the assassination. And the assassination came and they held the movie back for a couple of years and didn't release it.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I'm not talking Manchurian. This is a more recent one.
Yeah.
Also on that amendment.
It was the Vice President and the Secretary of Defense that were trying to have a vote.
Well, good questions about that amendment come up in the West Wing episode where Jed Bartlett temporarily hands over power to the Speaker of the House. If you saw those episodes. Because he was not Vice President. Vice President quit over womanizing.
Now, have you told us what happens? I thought you said there was something about Vice President in the 25th Amendment.
That instead of it leaving, we can talk about this in regards to Nixon and Ford, that there's no gap left. You have to fill the gap. So the first time it's actually tested, let's talk about that because that could be on the test, is when in 1973, October 8th, Nixon's vice president is forced to resign because of his involvement in bribery and tax evasion as governor of Maryland, Spiro Agnew.
He has an American history board game.
So when Agnew is driven from office, there is that vacancy, and it has to be filled, and the amendment's put into place, and who fills the vacancy?
Gerald Ford,
the Senate or House Minority Leader, is appointed.
So you can just, the President can appoint whoever? The
President appoints, and the Congress ratifies or certifies.
Confirmed,
yeah. And then, as good fortune for the nation would have it, on August 9th, 1974,
Nixon goes away.
Nixon himself has to resign, and therefore what happened for the first time?
Non-elected president.
Moves up. Ford moves up to president as the first person to ever become president without being elected to either of the first two offices. And it was very much on Ford's wishes that he win re-election to show that people really did vote for him for president, and he loses to whom?
Carter, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Because there is no Soviet domination of Poland. As well as the pardoning of Nixon, that kind of hurt too.
I think that was a bigger thing.
Oh, I think the West Wing womanizing thing was kind of ripped off from Clear and Present Danger, or not Clear and Present Danger, but I forget what the title of the book is by Tom Clancy.
I'm just kidding.
Now, once Ford assumes the presidency in 1974, that's a vacancy in the vice presidency. So who replaces him?
Rockefeller?
Nelson Rockefeller, governor of New York, brother of Winthrop.
That's Rich Foster.
Those are the times when I was just getting out of college and going into teaching, when all that's the end of Watergate, end of Vietnam, and the changeover, and it's a really eventful historic times going on. The fact of this.
Was the news coverage, were you finding, like, did you know what was happening, or was it 10 years later after that?
Think about news coverage in 1974 and 75. There is no cable network news. All your news is from the night. If you don't catch the nightly news from 5:30 to 6, then you don't get it again until the next day. There's no nightline. There's just a once-a-day news broadcast or newspapers and magazines, which means that if it's newspapers and magazines, you don't get the most... Yeah, there's no internet.
Okay.
So there's no current news. That's one of the things that really caught my attention was this. In the 2000... Remember the 2000 election mess, where every single day a court case could change whether or not they're going to count the votes in Florida and Warren Bush... The thing I noticed was that we'd gotten used to internet news, but internet news was too slow. If they didn't update their pages fast enough, you couldn't know what changed in the vote count.
So you had to vegetate in front of Fox News.
So you had to stay in front of cable news all the time to catch what was going on. I thought, what a change it was from the day and age when there was no cable news, or there was no internet. And you just had to check the newspaper the next day.
Because if you notice, there's always like that 5-minute delay in between the actual news happening and the updating on the site.
So. Are we better off for all that coverage?
No.
Number 13, LBJ is the first president to be from the South since Woodrow Wilson who is not even really remembered as a Southern president. He was Virginia born, but he's remembered as a New Jersey president. He will be probably the most powerful and effective lobbying president. What I mean by that is he, many times presidents depend on White House staff and congressional members to help them get bills passed. But Johnson, as a Senate foreign, as a Senate majority leader in the 50s, had the experience of how to get things done, how to make favors, how to log roll and trade things. As a president, he used all that. He used it real well. And some of the things Johnson used were probably not what we'd say is very ethical, but they were very effective. And that is, Johnson made it his business to do research on every single congressional member, especially what closets had what skeletons within them.
So then who are we talking about?
LBJ. And when it came time for things like the Civil Rights Measure, the Voting Rights Act, or other pieces of his Great Society, social legislation came through, he'd get those votes counted up, and he'd watch day by day, are they still on board, have they switched, have they lost? That was his major focus. And the people who were just dead set against his legislation, he would use what's called the treatment. He would call them to the White House, or he'd go visit them, and he'd stand right over them and intimidate them and pressure them in order to commit that they would vote his way.
When did J. Edgar Hoover leave the FBI?
72, when he died.
And he's the guy who did that same thing to Kennedy about the Marilyn Monroe thing?
Mm-hmm. So the LBJ treatment, many a times, would make an opponent crumble and vote his way. And if the treatment didn't get him, then the stories of what about the dead boys you slept with back when you were in your 20s.
But the dead boys?
I'm kidding. I'm joking. But what I'm saying, in other words, the most embarrassing experiences that those legislators had in their life. Okay, those just don't need to be in the news, do they?
Now, when did...
Last year was the Filipino boy.
So that's what I'm saying is that LBJ... No. Manipulatively got to the state. He knew how to get laws passed. He knew how to force people and pressure people. Now, that sounds pretty manipulative and conniving, but would there have been civil rights without it?
What are civil rights?
The equality. Equality.
There will be a day when that's really asked like that.
No, what I'm saying is, it's...
Sorry, did you see Jones?
He was just role playing.
No, what I'm saying is, it's the right to be able to make free choice.
Okay.
And that's
civil rights is a generic term that in this time period specifically means equal rights for black people.
Okay, I know, yeah. But it's equal rights for black people. So these people, these congressmen, aren't being given their rights because they're being pressured.
Whoa.
Never mind.
They're being pressured by the people that reelect them.
So no, that's not what I'm talking about. Do you see anything at all that I just said?
I do, and it worries me. Legislators, when they get to the point where they're immune from outside influence...
No, LBJ isn't there...
He's one of the other branches. Couldn't they just said, hey, you're the president, we're Congress?
Okay.
You've got closets, too?
Say it wasn't for a good cause, though.
Yeah, I'm flirting with the whole "in justifies the means."
Would you like George Bush to do this to the Congress now?
For national health insurance?
No.
To get us out of the war in a hurry?
How about to extend the war?
I bet you if he tried it, I mean...
Well, he couldn't do it. That's true.
Cheney could do it?
No, not with the Congress.
Okay, I'm not approving of his methods. But I am saying it's interesting that some of the best legislation we needed at the time did come from these methods.
Now,
wasn't there
something in a like early post-revolution time where someone had a good cause to threaten secession, but just it's
Burr?
Yeah, what was it? No, well, wasn't there someone who did something
in that whole forgiveness?
And it wasn't for a bad cause, but then it kind of set a precedent.
Yeah, I see what you're saying in terms of the nullification.
So maybe the means doesn't always...
I'm not a "in justifies the means" kind of person. I was just telling the story of the historian.
Well, in some cases it does justify the means.
Okay.
But you are right. We could have had presidents, and we probably have had presidents who had that kind of presence to enact bad legislation.
I find it scary that one person can... affect the entire Congress.
Well, I would say this, that when it comes to use of power or even abuse of power, our current administrator has been far more abusive than Johnson. That's my personal opinion. That's not on AP test.
That won't be at A, B, C, D.
No, no, that's just for Bin Laden there.
That'd be horrible if there's like three questions like Bush is mad because on the AP test.
Well, they Bush won't be on the stage yet. Well, he might be.
I think the
current events questions in AP test sometimes at most are 4 or 5, and sometimes none past the 70s. But if they do, what do you think of the Bush administration? What things would be the most significant to ask?
Probably the Patriot Act.
The war itself, the war on terror.
They probably might ask you to compare the terrorism scare to the Red Scare of the 50s.
Okay, but they won't ask you to know that. That's way too current stuff to know. It'd just be a multiple choice question. But start of the war, maybe Afghanistan,
maybe
the Social Security thing, but that's way too recent.
No, that goes back to Goldwater, though. Mm-hmm.
But probably more than anything, the election outcome, the way the first election went with Gore. So LBJ, that's what I really want to stress was, as a Senate Majority Leader, had learned the ability to lobby legislation very, very early on, and was excellent as a president in getting it done. And that's how he was not only able to get civil rights measures passed, but many of the great society social programs that you see in number 14 were accomplished through his forceful personality. And, of course, a Democratic majority control of Congress.
Can you help?
What's the Great Society?
Great Society is, in many ways, well, I should have added it in what I was talking about earlier. Great Society. If let me back up. FDR has the New Deal. Mm-hmm. Kennedy has the New Frontier. That's LBJ's domestic policies. And they are focused on trying to continue to provide social spending for the needy, and opportunities in the way of job training programs and college loans.
Is this the last of the named social programs aside from the joking names like Reaganomics?
Probably, unless... Well, see, Reagan had what was called New Federalism.
Oh, yeah, that's when the government passed.
Yeah, and Clinton tried to have something called the New Covenant, but it never went anywhere. So probably, yes, this is the Great Society's last of the big, well-remembered ones.
Aside from Reagan's domestic policies, also known as Reaganomics. Mm-hmm. That's a joking name.
Do you remember what... This could be on the ABTS. Maybe it has been on the past. George Bush the Elder, before he was president, what post did he hold?
Vice President Reagan.
Right, and they ran together in 1980 and again in 84, right? Mm-hmm. But many people don't remember this, that in the 80 election... You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
That in the 80 election, Reagan and Bush competed for the nomination, and Bush came in second, and they combined forces and he became running mate. But before he became running mate, he criticized Reaganomics as well.
Voodoo economics. Yeah.
As what?
Voodoo economics.
It's true.
Yeah, it disappeared after he became running mate.
Voodoo economics.
It became the witch doctor.
So, federal aid to education. Aid to medicine. In fact, it should be somewhere in the list. Medicare and Medicaid are two of the programs that come. Here they are in number 19. If you look at number 19 on the next page, following re-election, more great society programs come in the list and lineup in number 19. Increased federal aid to education, Medicare, Medicaid, the creation of the Housing and Urban Development branch, National Endowment for the Arts, National Endowment for the Humanities. Are you on number 19 with me, or am I just all by myself?
I'm on
19.
Okay.
Going.
What does the National Endowment for the Arts do?
Promotes the arts.
Build museums and crap.
How?
Crap.
Grants of money. They give grants of money to institutions and individuals to paint dirty pictures and write filthy plays. And I'm just teasing. That's a lot of conservatives hate the National Endowment of the Arts because they don't like federally funded arts, and especially the fact that sometimes some artists get a little bit unique.
Liberal.
Not just liberal. Hollyweird.
What did you say?
That's a Sean Hannity
story.
Water Quality Act, which dealt with trying to stop pollution of streams and lakes. The Immigration Act of 1965 was the change from the 1924 immigration laws, which were what?
The quotas.
What had the 1924 quota laws tried to do?
Limit immigration.
Limit search.
Limit the numbers and limit the sources to where?
to WASP area.
Nordic, yeah, WASP Nordic areas rather than Eastern European or Asian. So these Immigration Act changes in 65 stopped all the racist quota systems and opened it up to equal numbers from different places. That's what you said.
Is it based on like population of each country?
I don't know the details of 65. All I know is really what all I've written here is that the racial quotas were dropped. I think there has always been, since the 65, greater openings for people with greater skills or student temporary situations. Here's Ralph Nader again, and here's Rachel Carson again at number 20.
Now, we skipped, we haven't done 15.
You're right, you're right. Let's go back. So there are Great Society programs, which is also called the War on Poverty. There's two layers of them. They're right before re-election, and then the bigger number, number 19, after re-election. Here's a theme worth repeating. What happened to the reform movements of the 1840s and 50s?
They were mainly followed by a war and poverty.
They became pretty much into one movement, abolition, and then the war to end slavery occurred, and then we fall into a more conservative time period of no reform movements called the Gilded Age. Then the excesses of the Gilded Age lead to what reform movement?
Progressivism.
And then progressivism on many issues ends up being make the world safe for democracy, World War I, and that ends into the exhaustion of the 1920s retrenchment period, right? Then in the 30s, what reform movement occurs?
New Deal.
Which gets into making the world safe from Nazis again in World War II, which falls back into the 50s, conservative 50s. Right. Well, the 60s, again, are a time period of that same resurged reform activity. And you could say that the Great Society, War on Poverty programs of Johnson get consumed in offstep by
Vietnam
spending. And after Vietnam, people are sick and tired of sacrifice and reform and fall into the conservative Reagan 80s.
And 90s. And zero.
And yes.
So does the social spending go to Vietnam?
There's only so much. You can't run too many big deficits, so the money that it takes to run Vietnam in many ways chokes off any further social spending for the Great Society, which for conservatives doesn't bother them anyway because they've always thought social programs weren't necessary.
Well, what if you didn't have a war?
I think a lot about this. If we had not gotten into Vietnam, and if Humphrey had won the 68 election, what a different world it would have been. Let's do the 64 election.
There's been a war with the Berlin, or a world with the Berlin Wall.
How do your bladders stand 5 hours? I salute you.
I took two breaks.
Man, I ran out of Coke so long ago.
The 64 election. What an interesting election. Who is the president at the time of the election? Who is the vice president? Nobody.
Oh, yeah.
And he's going to run against the Republican from Arizona.
I would not seek nor accept.
That's coming later.
Oh, okay.
That's the 68.
Oh.
He's running against Goldwater, Barry Goldwater from Arizona, who was born when Arizona was still a territory, not a state.
And so can he run?
Well, it's U.S. soil, so I guess it's a constitution. Goldwater represented a philosophical change for the Republican Party. Because if we go back to the 1940 election, when Roosevelt ran for his third term, Wendell Willkie, the Republican, was a liberal Republican. He'd actually been a Democrat up until 2 years before the election. In 1944, Tom Dewey was not a hardcore right-wing Republican. He was very, very... New York Republicans who tend to be liberal anyway. He ran again in 48. In 52, Eisenhower was conservative, but he's more of a military man than a political man. Nixon had been, although conservative, hawkish on the war, on social policies, was really quite liberal as he ran as well as he was elected president. So when we get to 64, we haven't had a conservative Republican run for office since Alf Landon in 36 or Hoover in 32. And that's why Goldwater was such a watershed, because he was representing the new resurgent far right wing, the rebirth of the right-wing portion of the party. When he accepted in the campaign, he made lots of comments about how the way to stand up to communism, the way to win in Vietnam, is to use every weapon we have. And a lot of people were very frightened about the possibility that he would use nukes, causing the Russians to use nukes, accelerating what's going on in Vietnam.
Who is this?
Goldwater, Barry Goldwater. You ever heard of Bill Moyers? Had some specials on PBS lately.
He interviewed Joseph Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
Did he get fired?
Yeah, he did. Bill Moyers used to be, long ago, Bill Moyers used to be press secretary for LBJ, and he was a campaign assistant during the 64 election. He put together a commercial which was shown only once, and then they took it off because all the bad response. A girl picking petals off of a flower, counting backwards, 10, 9, 8, 7. When she gets down to the end, pulls the last flower off, you see a mushroom cloud below it behind her. And the purpose of the commercial was to say, if you let Goldwater, that's what's going to happen to you.
But what was he fired for? What was he fired for?
Moyers was fired, when was this? From PBS about half a decade ago?
That is fired recently.
He was rehired recently.
Why was he fired?
They grew up on that.
Too liberal?
Because PBS are supposed to be kind of fair about.
With all that tax money. There is a picture in here of Goldwater. But I think
PBS is but he was hired again.
Yeah, and that's a lot of controversy. Is why is this guy back again? Let me show you the Goldwater picture here.
Hey,
here's the swearing in of Johnson on the plane.
See that guy there?
Uh-huh.
He's the guy who made the MPAA ratings.
He just died here.
Yeah. Like 3 days ago.
Jack Fellini.
Sure.
And you knew him from this commercial? From this, you've seen this picture before.
That's him. No, they showed his picture.
It's Jack Fellini. Let me show you the picture of. Oh, this here is a U-2 flight over Cuba. Hello? Uh-huh.